Good morning, everybody. I'm sorry to bring us to the end of spring break, if you have been enjoying that. We begin a new week. It'll take a lot of you back to school. We hope the rest of the springtime, the sprint from here to graduation or whatever else happens, is a pleasant one for each one. We certainly have important things to do in our life together here. Please remember the ongoing process of selecting additional deacons, and remember the other activities that you can see at the back of the auditorium, and that we'll have next Saturday and Sunday as well. If you're a verse of the day person, like many of us are, or if you are maybe a verse in a frame somewhere, then chances are you'll have this one posted or hanging somewhere in a prominent place, a place that is you can see that brings these words to your heart. It's Romans 8, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to His purpose. That statement has been one that many of us have recited to ourselves. And it's been one that many of us have also puzzled over from time to time. I remember a comment I read from Brother Joe Barnett many years ago about this verse. He said, "No words in the Bible come to us with greater welcome than these. No claim covers more territory or offers more comfort and hope than this one does." This is the verse we all want to believe. We need to know that our lives have some direction to them, that the events in our lives can be worked together to produce something good, that it's not all out of control, are all for naught, that we're not simply drifting in a powerful stream that we have no control over in time. But this is also the verse many of us find at one time or another most difficult to believe, don't we? I'm not the only one in that way. Aren't there things that happen that are hard for us to put in this picture? I noticed that one reason we have trouble with this statement is that we, in order to really grasp it, we'd have to be able to see life from God's view. In order to process what this says, we'd really have to be able to see how it looks in the panorama of His own purpose. And that, of course, we can't always do. Another reason why it's difficult, I think, maybe even more so, is not quite so obvious. It's that what this verse says has sometimes been misunderstood. Sometimes it's been misapplied to people at the most uncomfortable points in their lives. And when this verse is misused, it really hurts, because it leaves the impression God has done something to us, that He's either let us down, or that He has planned something that's turned out to be about as hurtful for us as could be. So I think if it's a verse we all want to believe, and if it's a verse that we find difficult to believe, I sure think it'll be good for us to think it through for a few moments, and that's what we're going to try to do this morning. We could start by trying to sort of see clearly what we're dealing with here, kind of surveying the ground. And there are two things that stand out if you really take the time to notice. One is that Romans 8:28 doesn't just suddenly appear on a blank canvas out of nowhere, just to stand there in view by itself. Instead, this is a part of a very wonderful, very profound and meaningful line of thought through not only this whole chapter, but really from Romans 5 on. It's a part of a line of thought about God's children, God's family, and what we experience in life given the way the world is. The point that's been made is that being heirs, being joint heirs with Christ, involves also suffering with Him. Chapter 8, verses 17 and 18 said, sufferings that aren't worth comparing with the glory that'll be revealed to God's children, but sufferings that are still enough to make us and all creation and even God's own Spirit groan while God's family is waiting in hope. That's the line of thought. Our verse then will lead on to a grand overview of the eternal purpose of God, all the way from whom He foreknew to whom He glorified. As if God's rule over history is so certain that Paul can speak of it as if it's already completed, even though we still are waiting for the glory that He's promised here. That's one thing. A second thing that impacts our study some is not quite so obvious until you get to comparing translations of this. It's that our verse involves difficulty in both text and translation. But let me stop and say, it's not difficulty that's confusing, it's difficulty that enlightens if you really take the time to think about it. It's noticeable in the way the various versions or translations handle this verse. And then in the explanatory footnote you'll find in any good translation or any good study Bible, almost all of them will include something about this. Scholars will explain that grammatically speaking, the all things of Romans 8:28 can either be the subject in the statement or the object of the verb work together. It either can say in all, that all things work together for good, the way the King James translates it, or He works all things together for good, the way several of the other ones do. If you think about it, you can see that it's not simply saying that all things sort of on their own turn out this way because life is good. It's talking instead about God's work. Some of the early manuscripts, I'm told, have God twice in this text instead of once. So it reads, to those who love God, God works all things with them for good. That's an American Standard Version footnote of this. To those who love God, God works all things with them for good. So either way, our verse is more about God's activity in behalf of His family than it is about why things happen, why events happen, or how they turn out even. It's about what God does with His family. So that puts us in a spot to stop and to process this verse for a moment. And I'd like to do that with two statements, if you'll think along with me too. Just in now beginning to think about, all right, here's what I can say about this. First, this verse isn't describing God's way of dealing with people in general. That's an important observation. Other passages in the Bible certainly do that. Other passages talk about how much God loves the whole world and how He provides for everybody, sunshine and rain, whether just or unjust. Other passages do that. But this one is about how God deals with His family, with His children. This one is about people, how He deals with people who love Him and obey Him. What I'm saying is Romans 8:28 isn't a general statement of shallow optimism. It's not meant that way. It doesn't say that everything automatically turns out best for everybody. We appreciate optimistic people and optimistic outlook, but Romans 8:28 really is quite realistic in its setting. It assumes that God willed for us to be able to love Him and to love each other. And since God gave us the ability to make choices for that reason, He also gave us the ability to make wrong choices, which we have done and which our ancestors have done. Wrong choices have brought evil and all of its consequences into human experience, no matter who we are. We now face things that are inhuman, hurtful, hateful, things that were never God's will. All kinds of things happen to all kinds of people in this world. That's how it is. One commentator has this statement. This scholar says that verse 28 is not Pollyannish unwillingness to admit evil even when it slaps us in the face. It is the confession that because we are in God's hands, the kind of God who sent His own Son for us, as Romans 8:32 says, all things will finally resolve into good. And here's the key statement. Apart from confidence in such a God as that, heaven knows we would have no reason for optimism about human fate. What do you think of that? Do you think we would otherwise? Do you see it in our hands or in people's hands resolving itself for good? Or can you see it in the hands of a God who loves enough to give His own Son for us and to make it possible for us to live in His Son by means of His Spirit? That's the first thing. Second thing is, this verse isn't saying that all the things that happen are good. This is a more important part of processing this than at first is apparent. Romans 8:28 isn't meant to indicate that God plans sufferings and tragedies because they are somehow good for us. You know, our parents, when they raised us, would have those days when they would tell us, I'm doing this for your own good. That never did seem good, did it? Well, their love was disciplining us. That happens in the course of life. That's different than just putting something on the schedule in order to inflict damage on us. It doesn't say that God causes whatever happens because He knows it will be for our ultimate good. I've never been able to forget something I saw that Brother Cecil May told about. He told about something he heard after the death of a godly elder who was also a loving father and a grandfather and a husband and who was killed by a drunk driver one day. Someone, well-meaning, I'm sure, but someone commented to his loved ones, well, it was just God's will. We don't understand it, but God has His reasons. Folks, that isn't what Romans 8:28 is teaching us. That would reflect poorly on the character and nature of God to ascribe His will to what a drunk driver did. What Paul is saying is that God is going to be able to redeem His creation from that kind of thing, and that we're right to wait and hope until He does. But Paul isn't saying that everything that happens until then is God's doing. There's an evil one who does also. In God's providence, He may use troubles that come, and He may even overrule them overrule them, to train his people, maybe even to bring judgment on the wicked. But that's different from why they happen in the first place. Romans 8:28 needs to be handled by people who are realizing that some calamities just happen because the world has been subjected to futility, as verse 20 of this same chapter mentions. Now, hopefully that puts us in a position now to begin to understand what this verse is telling us in a beneficial way for all of us. We need it. That's why we all want to believe it. Someone commented to me one time that the best way to understand Romans 8:28 is to start at the end of it and work your way back through. So let's try that approach for just a minute. The very last phrase is, to those who are called according to his purpose. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them that are called according to his purpose. His purpose is really what this whole chapter is about. God's purpose is to have a people who are conformed to the image of his Son, verse 29 says. God's purpose is for those people to show forth his glory in a world where it's been marred and lost. And then ultimately, for these people to share in the glory he gives his Son as joint heirs with them. He wants to have a family. He wants Christ to have a people. He calls everyone to this privileged position through the gospel. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 14. The gospel is that God has loved us all so much that even when we were sinners, he has shown his love by giving his Son for us. The gospel is that Christ died for our sins, that he was buried, and on the third day God raised him up. The gospel is that on the basis of the work of Christ, life is offered to all of us. He wants to give us the spirit of adoption and to make us his own children. Romans 8 verses 15 and following tells us that. All of those who respond to the gospel in faith and obedience to it become his called into one body people. Colossians 3 and verse 15. God's purpose, which is so sure that Paul can speak of it as if it's already done in verse 30, then becomes the purpose of that people. We're going to understand the rest of the verse in light of that purpose that the verse ends with. And then backing up a little, to them that love God. To them that love God. Of course, that's another way of speaking of the same group of people we just described. This is a portrait of people who see God as a wise and loving Father and not somebody that they have to be forced to acknowledge because they're going to die and otherwise there'd be no hope. This is a wise and loving Heavenly Father, and these are people who return his love and who gladly and voluntarily and willingly submit to his guidance and depend on his care. In this context, in verses 7 and 8, there's a contrast that begins. It's between people who live their lives by the mind of the flesh, which is hostile to God and doesn't submit to God's rule, can't please God, and on the other hand, people who have the spirit of adoption, who cry to God, Abba, Father, and who live their lives by the Spirit of God. That is, gladly pursuing things that are in keeping with the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, patience, and self-control. Todd prayed that for us in our class earlier. You really think about it, it couldn't be any other way than this. How could God work all things together for good with people who did not share his purpose or his heart? God's working with us requires that we trust Him, that we are loyally devoted to Him. It doesn't require our flawless perfections, our complete maturity. It helps us along the way toward that. It's for us as real people, but it's for people who really trust God and love Him. Then for good. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God. For good. Good is going to be defined by the two things that we've just said. Not for what we find easiest. That's in childishness, that's what I think good is. Or not for what we think would be most enjoyable at the moment to our selfish selves. No, God defines good with the long view and in keeping with His purpose and in keeping with His loving nature. Good has to do with, will it conform us to the image of His Son? Will this make me more like Jesus? Verse 29. Will it make us partakers of His holiness? Hebrews 12 and verse 10. Will it make me a sharer in His nature? What will it yield later? Hebrews 12 and verse 11. God's later is very important to this process. Later on, what will it mean? Paul can think of being in prison in Philippians 1 and verse 12 and think that he knows by God's Spirit and by the prayers of God's people, it'll turn out for good. And what he means for that is it'll turn out for the progress of the gospel. That's good. And then notice, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to His purpose. Someone sent me the illustration of a grandmother who's baking, and she teaches this lesson to her granddaughter by offering her a taste of each of the ingredients that she was putting in the bowl to mix together. There's just dry flour, then there's raw egg, and then there's vegetable oil or some kind of cooking oil, and then there's vanilla, and then I don't know what all else. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Then Grandma mixes it all together and puts it in the pan and bakes it in the oven, and it turns out to be a delicious cake. A lot of the ingredients of life that are a part of what God is trying to work together for us are like this. All things has to do with, yes, the wonderful blessings mentioned in verses 29 through 30 of being foreordained, called, justified, glorified, conformed to the image of God's Son. That's all wonderful. But all things also may include the sufferings of verse 17 and the groanings of verse 23 and whatever else might happen in verses 35 and following, tribulation, distress, persecution, famine, nakedness, danger, sword. All things. And then together turns out to be the key. Any of those things by themselves would be out of balance and not, who knows what they'd produce. But together means that even when events occur that have no good about them, God is there. And He's silently intermingling these things into a pattern for the good of His children, of His family, of His people. Paul is going to say at the end of Romans 11, "Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom of the knowledge of God, how unsearchable are His judgments and how inscrutable His ways." How they're past tracing out. You don't see it happening, but you're assured that God is at work at doing it. No wonder patience and humility and submission and faith are necessary, as Romans 5, verses 3 and following said. And then work. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to His purpose. This word needs a little bit of comment and thought. If things work together for our good, It's because he makes them to, or he causes them to. In fact, two of the translations, New Revised Standard and New American Standard, translates them in those two ways. NIV has, in all things, God works together for good to those who love him. Or, in all things, God works together with those who love him to bring about what's good. The point is, he's present with us in the events of life. He strengthens us through the events that happen. He uses them to transform us into God's image and to get us ready to appreciate our inheritance. The God who has given his Son can be trusted to graciously give us all things with him. That is, all things that are good. Verse 32. So there's a look at the verse we all want to believe. Romans 8:28 is even more awesome when you consider what the alternative understandings of life's events might be. Are they like this? Or are they random, meaningless, useless experiences? That'd be the only other options. Most of us can't be content with that. God didn't make us to be content with that. Remember that these words are also not just the words of a fair-weather believer. Imagine the stuff Paul had been through when he wrote these words already. He carried the scars of Christ on his body, Galatians 6:17. Second Corinthians 11 mentions a whole series of things that he had already suffered. I can't even name them all. They range all the way from just beatings and whippings to shipwrecks and hunger and thirst and cold and sleeplessness and all of that stuff. But he still said, "And we know." That really is the invitation of this passage to us today. We don't know what will happen in the future, but we do know that God will be at work for the good of his children. I read one time the story of an older Scottish physician who was attending a dear friend of his in that friend's last hours of life. There wasn't anything else the doctor could do at that point. His friend asked him in one of those quiet moments, What will it be? What will it be like after I die? And the doctor is just quiet, thinking, how in the world can I answer this? And about that time, he hears a scratching at the door of the bedroom. And he said to his friend, "Do you hear that? That's my dog. He's grown impatient. He's been waiting for me to come out. He has never been in this room. He has no idea what it's like in here. I've never allowed him to be in this place. All he knows is that I am in here, and therefore he wants to be here." And he said, "All I really know about what it will be like after this is that he is there, and that's enough." We have to decide where we want to be. He wants us to be with him, and that's the thing that we encourage and we embrace through the gospel. If you're here this morning wanting to place your faith in the gospel of Christ, to be obedient to it, we offer an invitation. Of course, it's always open. If we can help you, you might let us know by coming while we stand and sing this song.